I'm Emily, and you're listening to the Politics in Action Report at CJMQ 88.9 FM. I'm bringing you your local, provincial, and federal political news. Now with local news. It has been in recent headlines that student-run organizations across the country have been receiving anonymous packages from Amazon. The contents of the packages include sex toys, light bulbs, and radio computer parts, all the while the sender remains unknown. Some of the universities who have received these packages include the University of Regina, Dalhousie University, Ryerson University, Wilfrid Laurier, and the University of Manitoba. Recently, the Student Representative Council, the SRC, at Bishop's University has announced they have received a package as well. The SRC has stated that they have been receiving packages since November and have received more than 50 items. Sex toys, barbecue equipment, skincare products are among the items the SRC has received from the mysterious packages. Bishop's SRC plans to hold a trivia night, and the items received in these packages will be given as prizes. Amazon, as well as the federal government, are attempting to solve who is behind the mysterious packages, which remains difficult given the buyer has been using prepaid gift cards, which are not easily traceable. These packages have been sent as early as the fall, which initially wasn't given much thought of, other than perhaps it might have been a prank. Now, with a greater volume of anonymous packages sent to various universities across Canada, student unions are wondering the purpose behind these anonymous packages. Some of the contents of the packages are worth, I'd say, approximately $60, which makes for a very expensive prank. Without any answers, student unions could only keep guessing the motive behind these packages. The city of Broma has aspirations for their beloved Mount Broma, a ski resort that attracts tourists from near and abroad. The city of Broma has plans to reserve a nature park, protecting approximately 150 hectares of natural environment situated around Mount Broma. However, these plans are at a standstill, with the city awaiting for a response from the provincial government to subsidize with a balance of $2.5 million for the project. The city of Broma is contributing approximately $2.7 million for the project, which in total will cost $8.2 million. If the city does not receive the funds by February 28th, an alternative investor has plans to construct 27 houses and ski resorts. So it appears the provincial government's delayed response has put the prospects for this project at a standstill. I will provide an update whether this project falls through at a later date. And for those who do not know Broma, it is a beautiful city, and driving by Broma, you can't help but notice the many homes and ski resorts. So there is a need to protect the forestry and preserve the natural essence of the area. Lennoxville's very own local MP Marie-Claude Bibeau has recently made an announcement this past Tuesday that funds will be allocated to combating female genital mutilation in West Africa. Approximately $3 million in funds will be designated to a project aimed at eliminating FGM in West Africa. Bibeau, as you know, is the Minister of International Development. This is the first governmental project aimed at preventing FGM. This was sparked by the removal of the clause that discouraged the practice as issued in the Canadian Citizenship Guide for newly arrived Canadians. The Liberal government is looking to restore that clause. As you know, performing FGM in Canada or on any Canadian citizen is illegal under the Canadian Criminal Code and is classified as gender-based violence. There are no health benefits of this practice. In fact, it is known to cause mortality in some cases. Part of the explanation as to why this practice is continuing today is because it is culturally embedded. There is a stigma associated with those who do not get FGM performed on themselves, and this has led young girls to get bullied by other girls who have not, or perhaps not yet, have had FGM performed on themselves. Without it, girls are put to shame, which encourages them to get it done. Associating this practice with one continent is a misconception, My professor last semester had explained that there have been some cases of FGM in Europe and North America, but it is mostly dominant in the African and Middle Eastern regions, and that is partly because we have laws that prohibit the practice. There are laws in effect to limit the practice within these countries, but these laws set in play are not well enforced. Bibo's passion for this project comes from her experience serving as an aid worker in the country of Benin, whereby FGM is highly prevalent among girls. Currently, more than 200 million girls and women from 30 countries have gone FGM, according to UNICEF. We can see members of the Liberal cabinet taking aims at promoting gender equality. The Prime Minister himself has even shuffled his cabinet to have half men and half women. As we have seen, Bibo is demonstrating leadership and is taking an active role in promoting gender equality. Quebec Premier Philippe Couillard announced last week that the provincial government plans to invoke tax cuts for both medium to small businesses within the next provincial budget. This tax cut is proposed to relieve pressure on small to medium-sized businesses when it comes down to new pension rules and the minimum wage hike. While not going into specifics, Couillard did assure that the government would be careful so as to maintain their fiscal and financial responsibilities. This is something Quebecers, especially the middle to lower class, are impacted by, and they make up the majority of the population, so it is imperative that they have some spending power and mechanisms to function adequately in our economy. This gives small to medium-sized businesses as well a fair trial at competing in our economy. With the upcoming provincial election means campaigning, debates, and heading to the polls. Premier Philippe Couillard is already throwing punches at his opponents, in particular the CAQ. Couillard stated the CAQ is not the party Quebecers should vote for if they want a change in government. Couillard takes his criticism further by citing the CAQ changes its positions on policies as the wind changes directions. CAQ leader François Legault fired back, stating Couillard is invoking an electoral campaign based on fear. What Legault is touching on, I believe, is the matter that Couillard's Liberals are losing the francophone vote. In fact, the CAQ is leading in the polls. According to polls that come from Ledger Polling, the CAQ is leading with 39% of participant support, followed by the Liberals at 25% and the Parti Québécois at 20%. Despite the PQ being behind at least 5 percentage points from its political rivals, the party remains optimistic they can make a comeback throughout the election campaign. As you know, the next provincial election is in October, giving a few months for Quebec parties to mobilize and campaign on their political platforms. The latest poll conducted demonstrates the CAQ is leading with 34%, the Liberals with 30%, and the PQ with 23%. While polls are a useful tool to formulate predictions in terms of the outcome of election, it's a form of analysis where it does have flaws. For one, these opinion polls that represent participants' opinions are not fully representative of the Quebec population, so already there is missing data and we cannot generalize these results. I wouldn't rely solely on these opinion polls to give cold hard evidence as to which party will win the provincial election. What these polls can do is provide an idea of what to expect in the upcoming provincial election. What they do tell us is that it will be a close election. The party's relative support is not far apart from one another. An analysis of the poll indicates a shift in support. Now, I once had a professor who described voters in Quebec as tropical fish who go from one coral reef to another. And so, as such, the CAQ has been gaining support from francophone Quebecers as the Liberals are lacking in this support. Couillard's approval ratings are relatively low, granting the opportunity for opposition parties to become the preferable party. CAQ has definitely become a party of interest. The CAQ was a party founded in 1994 and has since been increasing their electoral support, coming out as a strong political rival, especially in this coming election. We can see they are leading in the polls. despite being behind in the polls, the PQ remains optimistic that they can make a comeback by October. I am expecting for the PQ to perform better than what the polls are predicting, because the PQ is a strong competitor, and after a decade of power, voters tend to experience a fatigue with the political party and will shift their support from one political party to another. That is what we see with this election. Couillard's approval ratings are down, fatigue is evident, and I wouldn't be surprised to see the CAQ or the PQ win the next election. The PQ has won about 5 elections, so that makes about 20 years in power since 1968. So it's essentially established itself as one of the main political opponents in Quebec. The last time the PQ was in power was under the minority government of Pauline Marois in 2012. Marois became a bit overconfident, thinking she can win the popular support, and called an election in early 2014, so about 18 months into her reign. Marois's strong stance on separatism proved to be a disadvantage and, I believe, ultimately contributed to the loss to Philippe Couillard and reducing the PQ to 30 seats, making them the official opposition. Despite some arguing the PQ is slowly phasing out of the playing field in provincial politics because they have promised to, you know, not propose a referendum, I don't see this as the reason. PQ has been playing down the separatist rhetoric because it's generally less favorable today than it was late 20th century with our referendums. It's important to remember that there are competing parties like the CAQ, so Quebecers have greater alternatives. As well, I don't think the PQ is phasing out. Remember that the PQ had selected its leader, Jean-François Lisée, in October 2016, so it's in the phase of establishing the new face of the party. I'm expecting the opposite to what these polls predict. In this next election, we will see that the PQ is going to strive to make a comeback. Looking to make a comeback after their opposition, the Liberal Party, has maintained power for approximately 10 years, excluding when PQ held a minority government in 2012. Within the months leading up to the Quebec election, I will provide greater detail and updates of what can be expected. The arm of a 500-year-old saint is making its tour across Canada. The severed arm of a missionary represents a religious legacy left by the saint who was said to have baptized approximately 100,000 people. The arm arrived in Montreal during the last week of January, where thousands of Christians paid a visit to the relic. People who had taken the initiative to go and visit the arm on display claimed they felt it was moving. Many devoted Catholics perceive the severed arm as a miracle because it has miraculously not decomposed since his death in 1552. The relic has been on a Cross Canada tour and will later return to its original home back in Rome. How was this relative to Canada, or how was the saint relative to Canada? It's a question I have asked too, so I imagine some people may be wondering as well. He was simply one of the most significant Roman missionaries of all time. He has actually never set foot on the continent of North America, but yet his religious significance persists today. It's interesting how we as a society want to keep things symbolic or of sentimental value, and sometimes that means the parts of the people we cared about at some point or another. I'll give you a couple of examples. The English philosopher Jeremy Bentham, whose head is on display in the University College of London. The reason for preserving his head was on Bentham's request, as he insisted on preserving his body as an auto icon, and so his friends could take him out at parties when they missed him. Then we have the former Russian leader Vladimir Lenin, whose body is preserved and on display in the mausoleum in Moscow's Red Square. Lenin's legacy as founder of the Russian Communist Party, and he inspired the Bolshevik Revolution and is recognized as one of the most significant leaders of the 20th century. However, there's been recent discussions of burying his body after his death in 1924 and being embalmed on display for approximately 94 years. Green Party leader Elizabeth May is finding herself under fierce accusations of her mistreatment from former employees. Former employees allege May bullied and created a hostile work environment. Nonetheless, the Green Party is standing behind May amongst these allegations, claiming they were coming from ill-tempered employees. May has since responded to the allegations, stating, "These stories are, well, laughable, except I'm not laughing." She reasons she is a tough leader, but doesn't perceive having a backbone as a character flaw. An investigation by a third party into these allegations is currently underway. From what we see here, bad word of mouth travels fast, and is the most impactful on a public figure's image. Whether May can overcome this, being a party that has acquired a popular vote of 4.7% in the elections between 2004 and 2015, her support is already low and definitely makes it more difficult for her to bounce back from this and repair her image. She will essentially lose confidence in her voters. Whether these allegations are true or not, they're out there and they have made the front page news, so it's difficult to come back from this. The City of Montreal hosted the sixth round of NAFTA talks the week of January 24th, 2018. I want to provide some background information of NAFTA before getting into the current status of NAFTA for those who do not know too much about it. So NAFTA came into effect January of 1994. It's approximately 2,000 pages in length, and it's one of the largest free trade zones covered, following the EU trade agreement, I believe. It has 8 sections, 22 chapters, and it's complicated but not complicated at the same time. It's essentially an agreement that altered bilateral relations between the three North American countries. Essentially, the purpose of NAFTA is that it removes tariffs and duties from goods as they cross the borders from the three countries. So this essentially relieves the price burden on consumers and enables products to be delivered to their destinations faster as they pass through the borders more swiftly. So the Trump administration is currently displeased with Canada's contributions to NAFTA, specifically in terms of reducing the trade deficit between the countries. So they want to increase U.S. exports and decrease Canadian and Mexican imports, terminate the supply management by the Canadian dairy and poultry industries, and the Trump administration also wants the auto manufacturing industry to hold 85% North American content, and 50% of which being from U.S. So these are not all the components on the negotiating table, but they're among some of the things up for discussion for NAFTA that I would explain. I will go over these components in greater detail, so to provide a greater understanding of what exactly is being negotiated and what Trump perceives as quote-unquote flawed. First, there is the matter of the trade deficit, which means Canadian and Mexican imports exceed U.S. exports, hence a trade deficit. Because you subtract imports from exports, and it makes up a country's GDP. The greater the imports, the more likely you will have a budget deficit. So naturally, the higher the country's GDP, the better off it's doing economically. Trump ultimately wants to abolish the agreement on Canadian dairy and poultry, and what it comes down to is Canada's dairy industry, which has fixed prices, production quotas, and tariffs, as explained by Barry McKenna. In 2016, Canada included within this segment unfiltered milk products, which is utilized to make yogurt and cheese. It was at that point that foreign competitors began to feel the impacts of this, including the U.S., whereupon companies were inclined to purchase milk products abroad opposed to domestically. So in the sense, it was harming American dairy producers. However, at the same time, this is a relevant component of the agreement because it ensures protection of our dairy producers, providing them with a stable income and ensuring that they can stay competitive. And this is not something Trump will back down from, as he had campaigned on making America great again. Yet, we have Canada wants to protect its dairy producers, so this is not something they would back down from either. So essentially, I think this component of the negotiations will be deadlock. Then lastly, there is the auto manufacturing dispute. Currently, 62.5% of auto manufactured in North America as a whole is needed to be qualified as duty-free, according to the Globe and Mail. Trump is currently demanding that vehicles require 50% manufactured in U.S. solely to qualify as duty-free between the three countries. As well, Trump wants 85% manufactured content in North America, which Daniel Dale from the Toronto Star stated was an unreasonable demand, considering the necessity and value of Asian electronics. What is even more stunning is how fast the Trump administration desires this proposal to come into effect, which would be sooner than the auto manufacturers are capable of doing. To say that Trump's demands are unreasonable is an understatement. That is why some politicians have contemplated the idea that Trump is just setting high demands because he wants Canada and Mexico to never go for it and ultimately tear up NAFTA. Trump is not backing down from the idea of Mexico paying for the border wall, which is an example. So Trump has stipulated that the deal cannot be made without Mexico agreeing to pay for the wall. Mexico has said time and again it will not pay for the wall. So the possibility that NAFTA will be abolished is generally unknown. With the unpredictable behavior of the Trump administration, Trump's political advisors have expressed their opposition for the terms of renegotiating NAFTA. So we know, in the end, the final decision will be made by Trump, and depending on the mood he is in, it will greatly impact the outcome of NAFTA. It is with Article 25 that a member country permits the withdrawal upon 6 months of enacting this article. Trump has made threats to pull the U.S. out of NAFTA with this article specifically. So it's interesting to note how Trump campaigned on the idea of keeping jobs in America. With the abolition of NAFTA, approximately 700,000 jobs, American jobs rather, will be affected. And this is coming from Economic Policy Institute. So already there's a conflict of interest. Trump wants to bring jobs to America, all the while destroy them in the process with tearing up NAFTA. It's as well important to note that bringing industries to the U.S., whether that's the majority of the auto industry or an air conditioning plant, means the U.S. will not be outsourcing for production, which could bring cheaper wages and rent costs, which ultimately means the costs of these products will be higher. Consumers are price sensitive, which means they react significantly to a hike or drop in prices, and a price hike does not sit well with consumers. With a price hike, consumers will either substitute the product if it's, not a necessity good, or cease to buy it if the product is not of necessity. The question then becomes, what is Canada's plan B if NAFTA is abolished? What does Canada need to do? According to Rona Ambrose, Canada will need to find ways to stay competitive. Frank McKenna has affirmed this by explaining that Canada will need to diversify its markets. This would mean importing products from international countries. Canada is the largest purchaser of U.S. goods. This will change if NAFTA is abolished, as Canada will be more inclined to outsource and import products from various other countries to achieve the optimal price. This is especially true for products that are off-season, such as strawberries in the winter, where Canada must import from the U.S., as you know, because Canada does not have the climate to grow strawberries throughout all its seasons. Some economists have predicted Canada would experience a recession if NAFTA was ultimately abolished, but nothing is solid in terms of the direction that Canada will be heading if or when NAFTA is abolished, so time will tell. So it appears the Trump administration is not being flexible, and maybe it's the beginning of the end of NAFTA. Negotiations can only go so far with the Trump administration dragging its feet. Canada will not give in to the demands of the U.S. if they're ultimately unrealistic. So I believe tearing up NAFTA would be detrimental because it would mean undoing all the process of trade that has been established for 24 years now. The effects of this would impact the economy, not only jobs, but on trade negotiations. Recently, members of the Republican Party have appealed to Trump to not tear up the deal. As of now, recent media has reported some process has been made in NAFTA discussions, and what is meant by this is that the discussions are less negative. There is a heightened level of optimism. However, I believe applying that old saying, don't get your hopes up, to the situation, because no deals were formulated as a result of the sixth round of NAFTA negotiations in Montreal. We'll have to wait and see if any progress is made in the seventh round of NAFTA talks, said to be held later this month in Mexico. I could go on and on into further detail about NAFTA, but for now, this is what I will cover until further developments. That is your Politics in Action report. Thank you for listening. I hope to see you the next time. I am Emily with CJMQ 88.9 FM.